Hello, everybody. I'm Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 62 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Handicapping the Wheat Market, which is drawn from a presentation Mike Krueger gave on the second day of Northwest Farm Forum, February 7th, 2018, in Spokane, Washington. Krueger came up through the industry working as a grain merchandiser for Cargill and eventually going on to establish the Money Farm, a Fargo, North Dakota-based marketing firm for farmers. He recently sold the company and was speaking under the auspices of World Perspectives. Krueger is a trim, affable fellow who, like any good marketer, sees the glass as half full, sort of like the farmers he works for. He writes the Wheat Watch column in Wheat Life on alternating months, and I always enjoy his more worldly view of the wheat market. It's easy being in the Northwest to think wheat is a big deal. After all, it's the region's dominant commodity, growing on more acres than any other crop. Listening to Krueger, however, brings me back to earth. He makes it clear that corn and soybeans are the big deal, and wheat on a national level. Well, wheat is being tested, that's for sure. Who would have ever thought, as Krueger says during his presentation, that North Dakota would be corn and soybean country? But that is now the reality, one fueled by genetic engineering with a side of climate change. I feel it's important to occasionally remind listeners that these podcasts are only a facsimile of the original. I'm getting pretty good at editing, and while I only use it for good, be aware, I have fit an hour-long presentation within a little more than 20 minutes, including a couple of questions from the audience at the end. Krueger illustrated his presentation with charts, maps, and graphs displayed on the giant screens at the Convention Center ballroom. But if you listen closely, and maybe more than once, his explanations tell you everything you need to know. He opened by telling his audience that a particular phrase is very popular nowadays, and that phrase is, "The world is awash in grain." It's true. I've said it myself. Then Krueger continued by saying that many believe there's no hope prices can recover. At this point, I thought he was going to switch the narrative and explain why that wasn't true. Instead, he said, to a certain extent, it is true. But
the one thing I want you to remember, if you don't remember anything else after you leave here today, is that the problem with low prices isn't because high prices kill demand. That was a buzzword 4, 5, 6 years ago when we were setting new all-time record high prices for wheat, corn, soybeans, you name it, was that, you know, high prices are going to kill off demand. That simply did not happen. In fact, world consumption has continued to go up every single year through those periods of record high prices, and it still happens today. There were a few little blips in there where world demand for either corn or wheat leveled off, but that was because that was during periods of time where we simply didn't have enough supplies to satisfy world demand. So instead of feeding as much wheat as somebody would have liked to back in 07, 08, they had to feed corn. So the demand leveled off. What high prices did, though, however, was brought us more world acres. They brought us better farming practices pretty much every place on earth because farmers could afford to do it. Farmers from here to the entire U.S. Began to use, maximize the best seed they could buy, maximize fertilizer, chemicals, fungicides, you name it. You did everything right because margins were great, prices were high, and that helped improve yields, including all the latest farm technology, precision agriculture. So that took place worldwide. In addition to that, though, we have had 5 consecutive years around the world of pretty awesome weather. We have produced 5 record world crops of virtually every commodity. That's unheard of. And if we do it again in 2018, prices aren't going to go anyplace. But there are already some things going on Earth that indicate that maybe we're going to come off of those record yields. And the degree that we come off those record yields, of course, is going to have a great deal to do with where prices go. We've also been fighting, in this country particularly, a very strong dollar. You know, and for years, the strong dollar pretty much hurt wheat exports because everybody in the world produces wheat, but we didn't have much competition in terms of corn and beans. That's changed pretty significantly now, as you'll see. We have Brazil and Argentina that are not only exporting wheat, but their big export is, of course, of soybeans, and Brazil has become our biggest export competitor in terms of corn. So the super strong dollar did hurt us, and the last thing I'll spend a little bit talking about later is cheap ocean freight hasn't done us any favors either. Ocean freight was mega high in 2007, 2008, back during the just before the global financial crisis when China was buying everything on earth from cement to steel to iron ore, and now it's at dirt cheap, which means our competitors can move their wheat or whatever to much more distant destinations, and it doesn't cost them hardly anything to do that, and I'll show you that as we go forward. So, we're in wheat country. Let's talk a little bit about wheat. This is world wheat ending stocks versus stocks to use ratio, world. If you look back in 05, 07, the blue was stocks to use ratio. That's where we reached the smallest ever stocks to use ratio. That's the year wheat set all-time record high prices. That's the year that legitimately there were concerns somebody on this earth might have to go without as much wheat as they needed. Well, we've had, as I mentioned, four or five record world crops in a row. So we've gone from roughly 20%, 18% world stocks to use ratio back then to where now we're at almost all-time record highs up at 36%. There's a lot of wheat on hand. It's not necessarily good wheat. I mean, supplies of course, good quality white wheat, good quality hard red winter wheat, and good quality hard red spring are pretty tight. Supplies of low protein, poor quality hard red winter wheat, soft red winter wheat are the ones that's very, very plentiful. In terms of days supply, back in 07, 08, if we wouldn't have harvested another kernel of wheat after the end of May, the end of the wheat marketing year, the world would have had roughly 75 days worth of wheat on hand. Today, that's ballooned to up just over 130 days. The important thing, though, long-term on wheat, that not many people in the market have talked about, just because the buzzword is we're awash in everything, is that almost half of the current supplies of wheat are held by China. China's a small net importer of wheat. They are not going to export wheat, and odds are pretty high that over the next several years they're going to just gradually kind of increase their imports of wheat. So here shows it a different way, and this slide's courtesy of U.S. Wheat Associates. So global stocks to use ratio, as I mentioned back in 07, 08, right in that 20% neighborhood. Today, we're up at around 36%. But if we take China out of that equation, that drops us down to about 17 or 18% back here, and we're only 22% today. So the fact that that ratio is radically different when you take China out of the equation simply is seldom talked about because they haven't had to talk about it. We've had awesome crops every place, and particularly in the Black Sea region, which is unusual. Here's what's gone on in Russia. So go back just to 03, 04, or even to 10, 11. That's when they had the big drought. But back here, they exported 3 or 4 million tons of wheat. They've had four or five consecutive record crops. This year, USDA is forecasting them to export 1.2 billion bushels of wheat. That's what the U.S. used to export year in and year out, was 1.2 in a really good year, 1.3, 1.4 billion bushels. 2 years ago, wheat exports from the U.S. were the smallest they'd been since 71, 72. And remember, it was 73 when the Russians became the biggest importers of both wheat and corn. So aside from the other factors I talked about, you know, cheap ocean freight, strong dollar, the Black Sea region has just had awesome crops. U.S., here's where we were again when we're at the low point in terms of day supply, and we had less than probably 45, 50 days left, and the USDA, we're coming down a little bit, the current marketing unit that we're in, down to about 150 days. My feeling is that based on what's going on acreage-wise and weather, we could see that drop off maybe a little bit more significantly in the coming marketing year. Winter wheat acres, if you follow these numbers, smallest since back in 1919, some people say 1909. The point is it's the smallest we've been, I think, since the USDA started to keep accurate statistics of winter wheat plantings. The big surprise in the January 12th USDA reports that sent wheat tumbling one more time was that me and every other person on earth expected to see another 1 to 2 million acre drop in winter wheat plantings. And instead, they actually left them about unchanged. And they said Kansas planted more winter wheat than last year. People that I work with in that part of the world say it didn't happen. We'll see. Those acreage numbers will be reviewed again on March 30th, which is really, to me, the next significant USDA report. That's when we get planting intentions, when they tell us how many acres of spring wheat, durum, barley, oats, corn, soybeans get planted. So I think that we're going to see that planted acreage number drop. The difference here, the red is harvested. And when those two numbers are close together, that means we had a pretty doggone good winter wheat crop, no different than here. When conditions are good, yields are good, we harvest more acres. There are those today who think that this, the difference between harvested and planted in 2018 may really widen out just because conditions have not been very good across the southern plains. And I'll spend a little bit more time talking about that later on. Other spring wheat acres. Here is where we were at the end of 2017. That's the number that they'll revise again in March. And there's some controversy or disagreements over where that number might be. People look at the price of hard red spring wheat futures-wise, people, I mean, outside of those of us who raise wheat, and say, well, you know, it's $2 over hard red winter wheat, so they're going to plant the heck out of it. But I've got good clients in eastern Montana who say, no way, they'd lose $40 to $50 an acre at current prices planting spring wheat, plus they're extraordinarily dry. And a good friend of mine who runs a big elevator, Rugby, North Dakota, way up north central, 20 miles from the Canadian border, he tells me every day, look at the price relationship between corn and beans. I mean, my guys are going to go more beans again in 2018 rather than spring wheat. I mean, they cost a little bit less to plant, and the price is almost double, of course, for soybeans. And depending on the year, yields can be, they've had good bean yields, fairly similar. But, you know, we're also super dry up there. How that plays out in the spring, you know, is going to play a bigger role. So what am I telling people about wheat? And I'll recap this later. We have sold just a little bit of new crop hard red spring wheat just because the fear of what might go on in terms of acres. Plus, we pretty well are assured that the gap between spring wheat and the other crops is going to start to narrow up, and it already has. But looking at weather, which we'll cover more, and some other things, we've just been saying, look, I don't want to sell any more old crop wheat today. And I want to just wait and on the new crop as well. We've got problems in the northern plains. When we get to a drought monitor map, this part of the world is about the only place that looks in pretty decent shape. And the southern plains are very, very close to a problem. Corn acres, we're expecting in 2018, I think they'll be lower. I think we're going to see, you know, North Dakota's become a corn and soybean state, for example, and we're going to see corn acres drop. I think lenders, for one thing, are looking at the situation and saying, gee, do I want to give you $350 or $400 an acre to plant corn? Or do I want to give you $150 to $200 an acre to plant wheat? And I think that decision is going to come pretty easy in a lot of cases. It's got to be the fringe states, the Dakotas, western Minnesota, you know, parts of Kansas, parts of Nebraska, that we see these shifts in corn and beans, because the primary states, Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, those states, you know, they just don't have that much wiggle room. They are not going to screw up their rotations all that much to shift from corn. So again, March 30th is the important date. Corn futures, to an extent, followed the wheat rally, plus weather, and then when the weather turned good and wheat collapsed, and yet here we've rebounded just in the last month or so. Okay, so not long ago, in one of the articles I wrote for World Perspectives, you know, when you look at what's going on with corn and soybean acres in this country, and then compare that to what used to be the other major crops, I mean, you wonder if we aren't headed just for two major crops. Here's all wheat, as we talked about. It's just acreage has just completely fallen off a cliff in terms of planting it. Barley harvested acres the same way, and I'm guessing we're going to be down again in barley acreage this spring. And from a longer-term perspective, if you look at U.S., Canada, Australia, Europe, barley is going to start to get really tight. I was surprised that the maltsters didn't come out with higher-priced contracts. We're seeing new crop contracts from RAR, Anheuser-Busch, the big boys out there of that 440 to 460 neighborhood, kind of the same as where it was last year, but with smaller acreage being offered. I'm surprised at that. People say, if you were just going to plant a wildcat crop with, you know, with nothing, what would you do? I might consider barley, if you felt comfortable that you could raise malting barley, because I think supplies are disappearing relatively relatively quickly. People aren't planting that, and there has been some crop issues, particularly in places like Australia last year. Yield risk. Just to kind of show you how awesome crops have been in the U.S. the last couple of years. So the 12-year average corn yield is 157 bushels. Last year, we set a record, contrary to what anybody thought was possible, at almost 177 bushels, and the previous record was set the year before that at 175. And as I mentioned, 2012 was the low at 123. 12-year average soybean yield is 44.5. Last year, we were 49.1. The year before, 52. If I were to look at these numbers and say, all right, what do we have to get to on a corn yield? How far do we have to come off of this to really significantly cut corn ending stocks? I think if we cut them for sure 10 bushels, which would be the third largest yield ever, you know, we would lop off 800 or 900 million bushels off the corn ending stocks number. I said that last year too, that we can't do 175 2 years in a row, and we did. But it just, the weather is different this year, the soil conditions are different. We'll have to wait and see. In wheat, the 12-year U.S. average is 44.7. 2 years ago, when the winter wheat crop was awesome, we set a new U.S. wheat yield record by 8 or 9 bushels an acre in 1 year. An incredible pop. A year ago, I mentioned ocean freight. Back in 2008, in the height of the big world boom, if you wanted to charter a 60,000-ton or bigger dry bulk vessel, you were paying $125,000 a day. If you were going to put wheat in it that day, it was almost 6 cents a bushel for every day you had the wheat afloat. Then the global financial crisis hit, and 2 years ago we dropped all the way to $3,500 a day to charter that same boat. Had you invested in one of these, in that price peak, which a lot of people started building them then, you were dead by the time we got to 2016. And people tell me that it was mostly hedge fund, you know, the big investment money that started buying ocean freight. So no more being built. The last one is just coming off the line, and now because rates are so cheap, we're starting to see, you know, the old ones go away. So today, we've come up just a little bit. There was the ebb, the lowest part here, but not much. So today, if we were going to do that, it would cost me 0.2 cents a bushel a day to move wheat. So if I'm Russia and have a big crop, back in the heyday of 2008, and wanted to move it to Mexico, which meant another 10-day sailing, it would cost me almost 60 cents a bushel to do that. Today, it would cost me 2 cents a bushel. See what I mean about collapsing the world, making it smaller? People say, well, it's impossible. The Russians can't ship wheat to Mexico. Yeah, they can when they're giving freight away. They sure can. The other thing that's kind of been on the back burner but continues to happen is these giant mergers and acquisitions of all the big players, particularly in the seed business. You know, Bayer now owns Monsanto. Kofco, which is a Chinese company, owns Syngenta. Syngenta refuses to import GMO corn, right? But they just bought the biggest GMO seed company on earth. So, I mean, what do you think is going to happen there? And who would have thought 15, 20 years ago that either Syngenta or Monsanto would ever have been the target of an acquisition? I mean, they owned the rights to every genetic issue on earth, and yet, for some reason, when everything crashed, they got in trouble too. China's been also aggressively buying world grain companies and fertilizer companies and infrastructure and spending huge money in Brazil. I just read the other day, yesterday, I think, that China will be either the number one, a Chinese grain company, either the number one or number two exporter of soybeans out of Brazil this year. So they're going right to the source, and they want to control the logistics grain company. The other thing that you're going to read about again very soon is the prospect that ADM acquires Bunge or part of Bunge, and then how the rest of it gets parceled out. You know, the talk is, yeah, ADM wants Bunge Canada, don't really want Bunge U.S., might be some trade issues with Bunge U.S., or antitrust deals with Bunge U.S. Anyway, but things have not gone well for the major grain companies since prices collapsed, and they all blame low prices, which I think is BS. They all blame too much supply. I mean, if you're a grain company, you want bushels. You want things to handle. I think it's like everybody else. When times are good, margins are big, people spend way too much money on export facilities, on ships, on people, you name it. When prices decline, margins get back to more normal levels, and you struggle. And that's what's going on among the big grain companies. When I go overseas, farmers, almost every place around the world thinks that every one of you, every farmer in America uses futures and options every day. Not true. I would put the number at 20, maybe 25%. My customers never want to lose money in a hedge account, ever. It's impossible. You ought to be happy if you hedge 20% of your crop and it goes straight up, right? You've still got most of it left to sell. Farmers hate marketing. That's never changed. The results are tough to predict. Women in marketing, almost zero. And every state grain commission, every state extension service, farmers union, farm bureau over the years has had seminars on marketing, particularly for women. Doesn't stick. Question is, how much upside for the price of wheat? I would think that if we get to late February without significant precipitation in the southern plains, we could see 50, 60 cents pretty quickly on wheat. You know, part of what's got to happen is we need to get above some technical points that trigger these funds to jump in and buy. And I think they're kind of right on the edge of doing that. Scott's question is, the fact that wheat is not a GMO crop, is that a positive or a negative? Well, obviously, I think it's a negative from a producer standpoint, because I mean, every client we have loves to plant a GMO crop. I mean, in large part, that's, I attribute that to one of the reasons we've seen wheat acres, you know, continue to drop, particularly in the central part of the country, in the northern plains, and in Canada, because farmers have much better GMO alternatives. It provides shorter season crops, all the things I talked about earlier. From a world standpoint, eventually it's got to be a negative. I mean, I thought when wheat prices went to 15 or 20 bucks back in 07, 08, we would finally see people on Earth, the Europeans and the Japanese, say, all right, you know, if we don't do something to change this, eventually those are going to be consistently good, that there, just because of the differences. And I thought we'd see this stuff go away from all the labeling, but that gets stupider every day, too, you know. Triscuits now, the new national ad on Triscuits, non-GMO. Well, yeah. Well, his question was, if you're afraid of hedging, how do you learn how to do it without losing a lot of money? There's lots of ways. Number one, I sincerely believe you got to do it. You can read about it. You can do it on paper. But until you have 500 bucks at risk, you're not going to watch it. You're not going to follow it. You're not going to figure out what you did right or wrong. And today, particularly today in this period of low, flat markets for the most part, you know, options are relatively inexpensive. So that would be the first step. At least you'll make you follow the market, and you'll know exactly what your risk is. I mean, over the years, all kinds of different groups have held hedging seminars, including me. Chicago Board of Trade, I still think you can go online, and it used to be free. They may charge you now, but they have a really good series of kind of self-training manuals on futures and options that you can order and take a look at. But you need to find a broker you can trust who you say, I want to buy a corn call today, and he won't call you 18 times in the next 2 weeks getting you to buy crude oil, gold, and everything else. And you can actually do it online cheaply now, you know, without even having to call somebody like me.
I think learning about hedging and options and puts and calls is a little like learning to create this podcast. It wasn't until I fully committed myself to the idea that I did the hard work necessary to create the radio-like magic now gracing your ears. The learning process was frustrating and took an inordinate amount of time to master, if indeed I have. I'm with Kruger. You've got to have some skin in the game to figure out how anything works, and yes, you will likely lose money in the process, just like I lost an entire episode of this podcast. Arr! But you'll get over it and move on. Until next time, I hope you enjoyed episode 62, or what I'm calling Handicapping the Wheat Market, from a presentation given by Mike Kruger at Northwest Farm Forum, February 7th, 2018, in Spokane, Washington. Please join me again next time for another episode of Wheat All About It!
Grass is fine if you've got a cut or 4 feet and stand in the mud, but we've got two and teeth to chew. Don't give us none of that vegetarian stew. We're carnivores and we ain't ashamed. The reason's simple, it's in the refrain. We feed you.